Welcome to Cover, KPFA's show about authors and books. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris, sitting in for Denny Smithson, who will be back next week. Today, my guest is futurist Jeremy Rifkin. Mr. Rifkin is the author of several best-selling books, including The End of Work, The Biotech Century, and The Age of Access. Mr. Rifkin is a fellow at the Wharton School's Executive Education Program at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also president of the Foundation on Economic Trends in Washington, D.C. He's written a new book called The Hydrogen Economy, The Creation of the Worldwide Energy Web and the Redistribution of Power on Earth. It's published by Tarcher Putnam. Jeremy Rifkin, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You actually don't get to hydrogen till about halfway through the book, but you do a very good job of getting across the message that we're basically at the end of the hydrocarbon age. And one of the interesting early points for me was you mentioned the laws of thermodynamics. In layman's terms, what are the laws of thermodynamics? And from a public policy perspective, why should we care?
Well, you know, economic theory, classical economic theory, is based on Newtonian mechanics. And, of course, the laws of gravity, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And that metaphor was used in economics to create the idea of supply and demand. And that there's nothing else that counts. It's just about balancing supply and demand. That doesn't tell you much. In the real world, economic activity is about how things get used up, how we take things from nature, reprocess them, turn them into things that we use, and then they end up back in nature in a degraded state. That's the laws of thermodynamics, the energy laws. The first law of energy says you can't create or destroy energy. All the energy that's in the universe today was here from the beginning of history and will be here to the end of history. However, energy always changes form, but only in one direction, from usable to used up, from concentrated to dispersed, from ordered to disordered. So if you take a piece of coal and you burn it, the energy's not lost, but it's now dispersed gases. You can't get any useful work out of it anymore. That's what we call the entropy factor. Entropy is the measure of unavailable energy that no longer can do useful work for you. So economics really is about thermodynamics, and it changes everything around just radically in terms of our assumptions. For example, we tend to think that everything in nature is waste until we add human labor and value to it and create wealth. But thermodynamics tells us that everything in nature is valuable energy until we transform it into temporary goods and services that end up eventually as waste. So whereas in the classical economic theory, we think of gross domestic product as a measure of our wealth, if you look at it thermodynamically, gross domestic product is a measure of the temporary value we've gotten at the expense of the energy used to convert it, and then even the temporary value eventually becomes dispersed, wasted energy no longer available to do work. So it really changes economics radically. I wrote a book in the 1980s called Entropy that was used for about 20 years around the world to help redefine economic theory using these basic laws.
One of the things that you talk about is how capitalist economics fails to take into account these laws. Does socialism do any better?
No. They both are really based on classical Newtonian mechanics. Neither are based on thermodynamics, so neither of them take into account these larger laws, and that's why we're in such trouble in terms of our loss of environmental sustainability. Neither Marx nor Adam Smith really understood it. No, laws of thermodynamics came in the late 19th century, so it came after Marx, it came after Adam Smith, so it was never factored into classical economic theory. Still isn't.
I've talked to some people who are interested in geology, and one of the things that they say is that in economics, you're interested in the short-term marginal market movements, like we monitor the price of oil options on the commodities exchange. And that tells you what the demand is at that moment, but it tells you nothing about the actual physical resource.
That's right. That's where the laws of thermodynamics, the energy laws, come in. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, so geologists agree around the world, and you surveyed a number of them in your book, The Hydrogen Economy, that we're reaching a global peak of production for conventional oil. So let's start with some definitions. What do you mean by conventional oil, and then what is the peak of production?
Conventional oil is cheap crude. It's oil that comes up from the ground, that's easy to capture, and that's easy to process. When geologists talk about peak, peak means half your global production of recoverable reserves and yet to discover recoverable reserves are used. Now, that's only half, but half is the critical point. Once you reach half of the production of all available oil reserves being used, then you go to the bottom side of the bell curve. Your prices start going up. They never, ever come down again. So the critical point for an energy regime like fossil fuels is when half the production's over. The conventional wisdom, and it still is the conventional wisdom as expressed by the U.S. Geological Survey, the Department of Energy, is that we have about 35 years left until we peak on oil production. And that's assuming a 2% growth rate in demand. And these figures can vary, but that's about an average. However, in the last few years, about a dozen world-class geologists, some of the best petrogeologists in the world, have been relooking at the numbers. They've been doing new computer model studies. They've been publishing the results in Science and Scientific American. It's not been on the public radar screen. It's kind of a behind-the-scenes struggle. They're saying, look, we think these figures may be wrong. Global oil could peak by 2010, no later than 2020. For months, I went back and forth between the figures and the statistics of the Cassandros versus the optimists, and then it hit me. What are we arguing about? The difference between the two camps is only 20 to 25 years. So what's clear is we're moving to the sunset age of the fossil fuel era in history, which began with coal in England. It's ending up on the oil fields and the gas fields in the Middle East and the stands. And I think that's irreversible. That is going to happen. The one thing they both agree on, both sides of this debate, when we peak, two-thirds of the remaining reserves are in the Middle East and the gas in the stands. So it's going to become even a more dangerous world in the next 10 or 15 years. And so much of the world's attention is going to be focused on who can control the oil in the Middle East and the natural gas in the stands.
You quote Kenneth DeFays, whom you describe as a pioneer petroleum engineer, and he thinks the global peak will occur somewhere between next year and 2009. I think the first thing is the idea that, as you've expressed it, we are really at a turning point in our civilization, and it's actually here for all practical purposes.
Well, it's on the horizon. He's a Princeton emeritus, very distinguished professor. I think his figures may be a little bit premature, but there are three crises now facing the human family. They're all connected to oil. They all suggest the end of an era, if you were looking at it anthropologically. The first is global warming, a direct connection with oil. For several hundred years, we benefited from burning all of the stored sun, we being the industrial north and the west. Now we're paying the bill, the whole world, the entropy bill, the actual waste, the spent energy, the carbon dioxide is up there in the atmosphere. It's getting thicker, and it's blocking heat from getting off the planet. So now we're beginning to see a great climactic change. Our scientists tell us we may see a temperature change between 2.5 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit. If it's at the upper range, 10 degrees in that area, that'll be greater than the shift in temperature from the last ice age to today. That will change everything. In fact, if you look at human accomplishments to date in terms of sheer impact, unfortunately, we'd have to say global warming may be the greatest single impactful accomplishment of the human race, even though it's negative, because we've now changed the chemistry of the planet in less than a century. When future generations look back thousands and thousands of years from now, all they'll have in the record to know we were here is that great climactic change and its dramatic impacts on ecosystems. That's the first crisis. The second crisis that's connected with oil is the north-south divide, the have and have-nots. Not as transparent, but very obvious once you look at it. The third world went into heavy debt when OPEC put in the oil embargo in the 1970s. Oil quadrupled in price in 4 months, and it never went down. So third world countries who were desperate to modernize and get oil started taking out loans from world lending institutions to pay for oil. They could never catch up to the price of oil. 30 years later, 83 cents out of every dollar borrowed in the third world is to pay back past debts. So they're getting no oil coming through the pipeline. And today, 89 countries are worse off than 10 years ago. Oil is the connection. And never before in history have we had such a divide where so few people control so much of the world's resources and so many are denied basic access. And even though, you know, the anti-globalists have taken to the streets and said, cancel the debt, amen. But unless we get beyond oil, the debt will come back 6 months later. The third crisis with oil connection, of course, is the Middle East. Bin Laden took his ire out on the West and America when we stationed our planes in Iraq during the Persian Gulf War. Now President Bush wants to invade Iraq, he says, because Saddam Hussein may have weapons of mass destruction. I take him at his word. That's his primary mission. But look, they're not naive at the White House. They understand there's a sub-theme here. Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia. If we came in and, quote, liberated the oil fields, unquote, the U.S. would be in a new strategic position to dictate the terms for oil in the 21st century. It's a dangerous game. So what I'm suggesting, when you look at global warming, increasing debt between the haves and have-nots in order to try and pay for oil, then the increasing possibility of war and conflict in the Middle East, compound that with the fact that we're going to see a global peak in oil at least somewhere in the next 20 to 40 years, we're ending an era. And we're now paying more to maintain this civilization and to buttress up this energy regime than we're getting net energy flow through to the human race. What I'm suggesting in this book, we now have to make a decision collectively, the next three generations, to find a roadmap to get us out of fossil fuels and into the next energy regime in history, and that energy regime is hydrogen. We know that's the next energy regime. The question is, how do we get there, and can we do it quick enough to avoid collapse of civilization?
Do we get there? One of the other things that is sometimes mentioned is we're now going to be in a permanent recession. And it seems like a yo-yo economy. The shortage will cause prices to rise, will depress economic activity.
Yeah, that's what everyone's worried about.
Do you think that's likely?
Well, that's the major concern in the business community. And it's no small concern. In the short run, if Bush goes in and invades Iraq and he's successful in the short run, it may bring oil prices down for a little bit, liberating, quote, those oil fields. But in the long run, over the next 10 years, we just don't have the oil. And more of it's concentrated in the Middle East. But it's going to cost more because it's a depleted resource. We have to move to hydrogen. Let me say a little bit about hydrogen. It's the basic element in the universe. It's the lightest element of the universe. It's the stuff of the stars. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And when you burn it, all you get is pure water and heat as a byproduct. That's the good news. The bad news is it's not free-floating. You can't just take it. You have to get it out of fossil fuels or water. Now, most commercial hydrogen now is being taken out of natural gas. That's a problem, because if you build a whole infrastructure based on steaming out hydrogen atoms from natural gas, where are you going with it? Natural gas is limited. It's CO2. It's a problem, and it's going to peak 10 years after oil. The more elegant way to do this is the way that the left community has been suggesting for 30 years. Take renewable energy. Take wind, photovoltaic, geothermal, hydro, biomass, generate electricity with that renewable energy locally. Then electrolyze water like you did in high school chemistry class. Separate out the hydrogen from the oxygen, store the hydrogen, place it in a fuel cell for power, heat, and light. Now, the reason you generate electricity twice here, even though it's somewhat costly, we cannot have a renewable energy society without hydrogen as the storage carrier. What I mean by that is when you take renewable energy, like the sun, and you generate electricity, electricity can't be stored. It flows. So if the sun isn't shining, or if the wind isn't blowing, or if the water isn't going over the dam, your economy halts. Hydrogen is a way to take renewable energy and then use it to electrolyze water and get that hydrogen so you can store it like coal, oil, and gas. Then you can have a predictable economy. So hydrogen is not one of many energies. It's the centerpiece for making a renewable economy predictable and workable.
How long do you think it would take us to get to a hydrogen energy regime?
Right now, there are about 850 companies racing to hydrogen. It's about where the PC and internet revolution was in the 1980s. It's about to really move out of the door quickly in the next year or two. Stationary fuel cells are already available for factories or homes and offices. General Electric is going to be distributing their stationary fuel cells next year. You buy a stationary fuel cell, put it in your office, your factory, your home, then you generate your own content. You generate your own electricity. Then, if you have surplus electricity, you can sell it back to the main power grid. 30 states allow you to actually, at the end of the line, send your energy back to the power grid. When you begin to connect fuel cells and everybody is sending power back to the grid, you have the beginning of a bottom-up revolution. Instead of power coming from a centralized source and a utility company, now all the end users are producing their own power and sending it back. That's just the beginning. The question is who's going to control this. But let me go through one more element of this, and let me back up and talk about it historically. The great revolutions in history are very few, the great social revolutions, and they require two things: a great change in the way people harness communication, and then a great change in the way they harness energy. They come together at some moments in history. For example, the great cereal civilizations, the first major hydraulic irrigation agriculture in the Middle East 10,000 years ago, to 5,000 years ago. They required a new language of communication between humans to organize it. It was called writing. because it required that kind of command and control mechanism to organize the complexity and the density of relationships of organizing irrigation and agriculture. You couldn't do it with oil culture. You could organize hunting and gathering with oil culture, but not agriculture. The print press emerged, and then a few hundred years later, coal and steam. Coal and steam power allowed us to increase the pace, the speed, the density of human exchange, compress time and space, but it required a new language to control all that increased density of exchange. It was called the print press. You could not organize a dense exchange economy with coal and steam, called the Industrial Revolution, with codex written in monasteries, longhand. Couldn't be done. The telegraph and telephone preceded the electrification of factories and the internal combustion engine. Point of reference. The last 20 years, we've had a great revolution in communication. The new smart technologies, the World Wide Web, the telecommunication revolution. Yes, it connected the central nervous system of a billion people, those in the have countries. Yes, we increased productivity by 1.5%, no small deal. But most of the companies that came and went, they were toys. There was no mission, these dot-com companies. They were not real. What's going to become clear in the next few years? The new communication revolution that we're so familiar with, it's going to become the language to reconfigure power grids all over the world. It becomes the command and control mechanism so that when you generate electricity locally in your own community or home, you can use this new language to move your energy to whoever you want, when you want, on your terms. You decentralize the power grids with a new form of smart technology, and it becomes like the World Wide Web in communications. And it comes with the same opportunities and the same challenges. Who will control it? You know, with the World Wide Web, it could be decentralized and democratic. We could have peer-to-peer sharing of information, but AOL would sure like to control the portals to cyberspace, and Microsoft wants to have you use their Windows. On the other hand, Linus, free open source code, is competing with Microsoft, and the kids are all file sharing independent of copyrights. So there's a struggle on who controls the web. When we get to distributive generation and hydrogen energy webs, they have the power of really decentralizing, democratizing energy, but who will control the fuel cells? The end user who generates the power? Or will the power and utility companies and the energy companies, will they own the end user's fuel cells and we just provide power back to them?
And let's for a moment talk about what distributive generation is.
Distributive generation is a fancy word to say you and I generate our own electricity where we are on site, factory, office, and home. Then whatever surplus is, we sell it back to the power grid.
Now, the thing is that you speak of this in a way as if the policy of how we're going to treat hydrogen, whether we're going to have distributed generation or not, is still a question to be answered. But you've also said a few other things in your book, The Hydrogen Economy, that I just want to quote here. You said, coordinating content rather than producing it becomes the mantra of power companies mm-hmm. in an era of distributed generation, and America Online, AOL, becomes the business model to emulate. AOL is one of the biggest mm-hmm. communications companies in the United States, if not the world. You also mentioned here, quote, since most commercial enterprises and homeowners are not experts in the complexity of the energy business, new intermediaries like Williams International, and those of us in California who are gouged know that name, a Tulsa energy company whose pipelines already transport 20% of the U.S. natural gas supply, will act as full-service suppliers. Williams International provides, and here I guess you quoted from one of their advertising blurbs, a complete energy service package financing the micropower unit, providing power from the grid, and helping consumers determine when peak shaving makes sense, and peak shaving is just getting off the grid, producing your own when it's cheaper mm-hmm. to do so. And I'm looking at another thing, and that is privatization of water supplies. We've seen that globally, and you're arguing that we can't make hydrogen from fossil fuel, that water is going to ultimately be the raw stock. Has, in fact, the decision been made by the corporations?
No. I can tell you, I work with some of the largest power and utility companies to try to move them toward renewables, and I can tell you they're just beginning this discussion. But they're going to be determined to control this. And so are the energy companies. British Petroleum and Dutch Shell are to be congratulated on one side and to be watched closely on the other. They're moving beyond hydrocarbons. Both these companies' CEOs have said, we are moving steadily. They're buying up renewable technologies. They're patenting them. They're putting huge hydrogen divisions together. BP's new slogan is Beyond Oil. Now, ExxonMobil's not playing. They're saying, look, yeah, hydrogen, but we're going to stay where we stay best, in oil. So on the one hand, congratulate Shell and BP, but on the other hand, be careful because they're going to want to control the whole thing from top to bottom. Here's the analogy, organized labor. One of the reasons I wrote this book is so we could all get in at the beginning of the process and really make good on a slogan we had in 1968, power to the people. How do we do it? The first thing we have to do is look at organized labor. I wrote this book at the very beginning of this revolution. You know, the left never got involved in the discussion of the World Wide Web. It was left to a small number of libertarians. They did a good job, Esther Dyson, Perry Barlow, but we on the left, we're always shaky about technology. We're concerned about it. Usually it has an exploitive aspect to it. So we didn't get involved in the web debate, the NGOs around the world. We can't stay out of this debate because this is about power and it's about energy and it's the basis of who controls production and distribution. It's the whole ball of wax. What we have to do is step back and take a look chapter and verse about how organized labor did it in the 20th century. It became very clear by the late 19th century that an individual worker could not organize their contract with a capitalist alone. We created trade unions. So every little energy power plant, each body and mind, collectively joined the unions. It took four to five generations, 70 years, for organized labor to be powerful enough to negotiate with capitalists, with the management, to share some of the gains of and the fruits and the productivity of the Industrial Revolution. That didn't occur until the 1950s. After a Great Depression and World War. We had 30 years of what I would call a balanced social contract, 30 years of benefit, at least in the industrial North and West, and then it fell apart again with the Reagan-Thatcher coal revolution. We have to have that same kind of steadfastness here with fuel cells and hydrogen. End users have to collectively organize that energy. Cooperatives, the great cooperatives in Europe are ideal. Here in this country, credit unions, community development corporations. Look at all the alternative financial instruments that the civil society has available. Use those as mechanisms to bring together people over the next 20 years to control the power they generate. We've just seen the first fuel cells come out in business. We're only seeing a few come out in homes. But it's just about where the first PCs were coming out and the first internet connection. So we're at the beginning. We have to have a very deep discussion about this because this revolution, the coming together of the communication revolution and hydrogen, will be as deep as steam, power, coal, and print. Remember, that revolution changed everything. We went from principality to nation state. We went from cottage industry to factories. We went from communal life to a bourgeois family life. It changed everything. We went from villages to urbanization. Hydrogen is going to create the same changes. What we need to do now is have a collective political discussion so we can help focus the kind of changes we want that'll be in line with our sensibilities. It's going to be a difficult, difficult challenge. So I'm not saying this is the next killer app. I'm not saying that this is all going to solve our problems tomorrow, but here was my time frame, and I think this is one that's workable. First, we have to aggressively maintain a position on fuel efficiency with internal combustion and with fossil fuels. Conservation, we don't give it up. We have to be very, very rigorous about conservation and fuel efficiency with fossil fuels. On a parallel track, we use natural gas as a bridge to start moving toward hydrogen. On a third parallel track, we underwrite and we provide the incentives by government to move renewable technologies to the center with hydrogen as the storage capacity, three tracks at the same time. I think a hydrogen energy grid can be laid down within 20 years. I think hydrogen will probably subsume fossil fuels as the key power source by 2050. I think fossil fuels will be boutique for special purposes by the end of the century. But then the question is, all through this map, who controls the production? The biggest beneficiaries here are the third world. As long as we're on oil, the third world can't make it. 65% of the people in the world have never made a phone call. A third of the people in the world have no energy, no electricity. If you're looking for firewood for 4 or 5 hours a day and dung just to heat up your rice, you're in trouble. But if we can begin, especially the civil society groups, the NGOs, and they are beginning to demand renewable technologies, get microcredit in there, get renewable technologies in the local villages, the fuel cells are going to get cheaper and cheaper. Electrolyze that water. You got to be able to control your water. It can be fresh, dirty, salt, but you don't want companies controlling that water or else you're really in a bind. And then begin to generate hydrogen, extract it, get the fuel cells in grids, and begin to produce locally. It could be reglobalization from the bottom up. The 20th century had to be globalization from the top down. All the activists take to the streets and they say, oh, my God, we don't have a fair society. Well, smell the coffee. Fossil fuels dictated it. They're hard to locate. They require military and political control to secure them. They're hard to extract. They create a lot of investment capital to distill fossil fuels. So the last two centuries, we created by the nature of the energy regime, a top-down command and control mechanism to control energy. And then, of course, we went from cottage industry to factories to have economies of scale to take advantage of fossil fuels, from steam factories to electrification. What I'm suggesting, because hydrogen's ubiquitous, if we can begin to exert control over the energy we extract, we could have reglobalization from the bottom up. That is, every community in the world could produce locally and sell globally. So instead of local communities being commodity providers or dumping grounds for finished products, they'd have their own basic self-sufficiency, and then we could have reglobalization in a way that's based on reciprocity and not in some far-off center of control of some big corporation managing the arteries.
One last question. Do you use hydrogen or plan to use it in your lifetime?
Oh, yeah. The hydrogen cars will be in the salons by 2009 because of what happened here in the state of California. I gave a number of talks in Europe last 2 weeks, and I mentioned Gray Davis's legislation. That legislation signed this summer says you want to sell a car in the state of California in the year 2009, you got to have near zero emissions. That means hydrogen. Now, the General Motors and the auto companies are suing California. But on the other hand, behind the scenes, a furious race to get to hydrogen. This is the largest automobile market in the world. They cannot lose California. They're angry. It's forcing them and pressuring them. It shows you what government should do, all right? Now, that's just the beginning. What you're going to begin to see is the auto industry is moving from the internal combustion engine to hydrogen, but they're still using fossil fuels to get the hydrogen. We want it to be renewables. We're going to begin to see this in automobiles first in the next 7 or 8 years, maybe earlier. We're going to see it in cartridges where you'll be able to power up your cell phone in the next year or two with hydrogen cartridges that last for 40 days. You won't have to power up your cell phone or your laptop. Home use, it depends on the oil crisis. If oil shoots through the roof and natural gas and electricity prices shoot through the roof, or you have blackouts because the utility companies don't have the liquidity to build new capacity, you can bet millions of Americans and others are going to start getting their own fuel cells and not depend on some power plant. So that's an if. So I think we're beginning this revolution. It's going to take a long time. But what we need to do, especially in the political community, is we need to frame the map. We need to be in charge of setting the course and not let it happen to us by the business community. There's room for all of us here. Let the business community develop the software and the hardware and let them manage these grids, fine. Let the end users control the power and energy that goes into the grids and let the government provide the incentives to get us there.
Okay, we've been talking to author and futurist Jeremy Rifkin about his new book, The Hydrogen Economy, The Creation of the Worldwide Energy Web and the Redistribution of Power on Earth, published by Tarcher Putnam. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Cover to Cover, and special thanks to engineer Anita Johnson. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris.